payment of the Hindus.
But the Jews create this enormous problem, the credibility problem, because the Christian will tell you Jesus was a Jew. And the claim is that he's the Mashiach. By the way, Yashka never claims to be the Mashiach anywhere in the New Testament. That's a claim made for him. So if Yashka was the Mashiach, if Jesus is the Mashiach, who should have believed in him? If Jesus is the Messiah, who should have believed in him? The Jews. Yet the Jewish people said with one voice, we wish he was the Messiah, but unfortunately he is not. And therefore it is only the conversion of a Jew to Christianity that can lend any credibility to Christianity, to the cross. Never the conversion of a Gentile. And that's why we're seeing this amazing push to convert the Jews, to undermine that credibility problem. You know, this is a very, very different experience for me. When I lecture, I usually lecture at universities, and when I'm there, my audiences are usually half Jewish, half Christian. I'm also often asked to lecture at Christian divinity schools. You're probably wondering why, but that's a whole other story. But about 10 times a year, I'll lecture at a Christian divinity school. Most of them are liberal Christian universities, not evangelical fundamentalist Christian universities. And when I'm lecturing and I make this point, sometimes I see the Christians in the audience. You can always tell who the Christians are. When I say that it's only the conversion of a Jew to Christianity can lend any credibility to the cross, because the Jews are the ones who said he isn't the Messiah, and they're the ones who saw him, they're the ones who should have known. The Christians are always going like this. And as a speaker, when you're lecturing in front of such a mixed, diverse audience, you know it's gahak tzaras when people in your audience are doing this. You know you're in a lot of trouble. Many Christians would disagree with what I just said. Many Christians would say, hey, Rabbi Singer, hold on right there. Isn't it true that the first Christians were Jewish, right? Isn't it true that all the disciples, right, were Jewish? Almost all the writers of the New Testament were Jewish? But the question again is, whom should they have been? Listen very carefully. Evangelical Christians will tell you, if you just look at your own Bible, I can prove to you that Jesus is the Messiah. I can prove to you the truth of Christianity from Tanakh. Then who should these Jews who became Christians have been? Should they have been our sages or those who are the most ignorant Jews? Anyone want to answer that question? Again, if Christians are saying that the very source and the proof of the truth of Christianity is the Bible, the Jewish Bible, Tanakh, if that is indeed true, then who should these Jews who became Christians have been, and who should they continue to be? Our sages or those who are ignorant? The sages, right. They're the ones who knew exactly what the Bible had to say about the job description of the Messiah. They were far more familiar with Ezekiel 37 and Isaiah 11. And why did I say Ezekiel rather than Yechezkel? Why did I say Isaiah rather than Yeshaya? Why did I do that with you? That's the truth. That's the real truth. I'm trying to make it sound like there's actually a purpose behind this, and there really isn't. It's funny, my father sits in Kol all of his life. He sits and learns. So when I spend Shabbos there, and he asked me to give it to Torah, and my brother-in-laws are all, Kol guys, very, Slabatkas, and so on. So when I start, and I say Leviticus, you just see my father sliding underneath the Shabbos table, my God. But part of it is you have to also understand their language. You do, because as I said, I hope that you'll be mechazik yourself before you ever step foot into a college. It's a very dangerous place. You will most likely not come out the way you went in. You got to be very strong before you go in. But you have to know also that, that your people need you. They do. They're dying out there. And you have an enormous responsibility to make a Kiddush Hashem as a witness in how you live your life, and also to teach Torah when you're there. And I hope you'll do that. I say that to you so that you understand the language of the world. See, if the proof of Christianity is from the Jewish Bible, then who should be those Jews who should have been lining up to get baptized? Should have been those Jews who are most knowledgeable. Our sages, of blessed memory, they should have been lining up long lines to jump in the baptismal pool and get baptized, become Christians. Yeah, what do we find? Who were these first Christians, these first Jews who converted to Christianity? Very much like the Jews who worship Baal and reopen Tanakh. Tanakh is almost a chronology of Jews worshipping idolatry, abandoning the faith. It's only a remnant that's still here. But what do we find? Who were those first Christians? They were prostitutes, tax collectors, fishermen and so on. Who are the Jewish kids, the young men and women today, who are joining the ranks of groups like Jews for Jesus? Are they young men and women who go to Yeshivot, who go to Bruyin and Rambam and Chabetz Chaim and the Mir? No. The one thing they all have in common is they all have, when they go to college, these graduation certificates, these diplomas from public schools throughout North America. Tells you a lot. And therefore, only the conversion of a Jew to Christianity can lend any credibility to the cross. What I'd like to do with you this afternoon is take you on a journey. I want to study this with you. I want you to understand the background of what's happening. One other point you must remember. In 1972, fundamentalist Christians came together and had held two huge conferences on the Jewish people in two very unlikely countries, Switzerland and then Thailand. Don't ask me, I have no idea why. Two countries, evangelical Christians come together and they want to realize that the church had failed in the past in their effort to convert the Jews to Christianity, and they wanted to figure out why had the church failed in their interest in converting Jews. And they found that indeed the church had a number of unique problems. The first problem they had was, they called it a public relations problem. What was the public relations problem? They felt that Jewish people tend to equate Christianity with persecution. For most Jewish people, right? You hear the name Jesus, it doesn't make most Jewish people very, very comfortable, right? Most Jewish people, you see a cross, does that make you happy? Right, you turn on TV and you come and stand, you're stationed there and, you know, the Pope's giving mass over there, he's giving, you know, whatever, the Vatum over there, he's standing there, right? So you don't say to your brother, hey, don't change the channel, I want to hear what the Pope has to say. Forget friends. What, friends? Forget that. I don't want to watch that. 90210, forget it. Let's watch the Pope. No, I'm sure that doesn't, I hope it doesn't happen, you want to watch friends, but Chach, I'm sure that you don't sit there and go, you're walking by a church and the doors are open and you say, come Chaim, let's take a look at that. Ah, isn't that so nice? I wish I could be in there and dance with them, do a rikida there. No, I don't want to go in, I don't want to look in there, I don't want to see, I don't want to smell, I don't want to touch. Do you ever like walk on the street and you see two like priests walking by you? Do you ever, with their show, you see that with these guys with the big shrimp, whatever they have over there, these guys, they walk around with the big high hat over there, and these hats are so big they have their own zip code. Do you ever see these guys walking around? Do you ever see these guys walking around with big black cane, they're walking around with a big dress on, whatever they're walking around with. So, what do you feel when you see, when you pass by priests? Do you ever see like priests walking by you, these guys, they have a big thing over there, they have like a chandelier hanging from their neck? What? Probably Hungarians must have it. How do you feel inside when you see these priests passing by? What does this happen to you? How does that make you feel inside? Somebody? How does it make you feel inside? Yes? You really want to get to the other side of the street. It makes us very uncomfortable. By the way, it's interesting. If you would see, I don't know, two Hindus walking there, would you feel as uncomfortable? No. You would? That's what surprised me. If you saw two Buddhist guys walking down there, you know they walk around in their orange pajamas over there? How would that make you feel? You'd say, Nebuch, these guys, you know, why do they have to get so many haircuts for? But, you know, you would basically... The Jewish people have an irrational revulsion to Christianity. It's irrational. I assure you that if someone told you my son became a Buddhist, it wouldn't bother you as much as if he told you he became a Catholic. Which is why. If he told you he became a Hindu, it would not bother you as much as if he told you he became a Christian. Why? Why? Yeah.
Catholic survival of religion against...
No one likes competition, you mean?
It's like the exact opposite.
Okay, that's very good. Very good, yes?
It's because Christianity came from the Jews and other religions, they sort of...
Very similar to what you're saying. Very good. Yes?
Because Christianity is trying to get people converted, so they get
what they sort of want. Okay, very good. It's very interesting that the three of you here are sort of speaking about the very competitive relationship the Jewish people have with the church, yeah? Guys?
Wait, what might happen then when you start to be a Hindu?
So he's saying something very interesting. He's saying, right. By the way, I'll ask you a question. Theologically, what do you think makes more sense, Buddhism or Christianity? What makes more sense? Let's say the American Indians who lived in this country that worshipped totem poles and the cockroaches and whatever else. What do you think makes more sense? The religions of the American Indians in this country or Christianity? What makes more sense? Those who said the American Indians are correct. Because you understand, as we're going to see in a moment, the American Indians believe in a sort of pantheistic polytheism. Say that fast 10 times. They believe sort of that there were spirits in nature. But you see, internally it could work. We're not going to get into it. That's not the purpose of this afternoon's program. But in general, the pagan religions of the world are far more logical than Christianity is. Because Christianity has a very serious problem. And that is, it's not a religion that can work internally in its own vacuum. See, if you ask, now there's any of you studied geometry yet? Did you study geometry in ninth grade?
Yes.
So you know, in geometry you have something called postulates. You remember the postulates?
Yes.
Okay. All right, don't start cracking away. I said postulates, you want to jump out the window. It's not so terrible. Listen carefully. See, every Christian will admit that the Jewish Bible could be true, Tanakh could be true, and the Christian Bible, Lahavdil, false. But every Christian will admit to you that it is impossible that the Christian Bible is true and the Jewish Bible, Chas v'Shalom, is false. That's impossible. You understand that? And therefore, Christianity is a very serious problem, because as you're going to see in a moment, what the church did was, it altered the Jewish scriptures, changed it, literally raped the Jewish text, our Tanakh, in order to make it seem Christological. See, so Christianity can't work internally, it has to depend on Judaism for its truths. The American Indians don't have to depend on anything else. And therefore, they're going to tell you that this, you know, this bird is God, so you either believe it or you don't believe it. So you believe that bird is your God, or you don't believe that bird is your God. But if Christianity is saying that the truth is dependent on Judaism, then we have a problem. And then when you say the very people that bring the concept of a Messiah to the world, the oldest extant religion in the world that brings the idea of one personal God to the world, that knowledge, is the very people that said he isn't the Messiah. When we desperately could have used the Messiah during the first century, the Jewish people created an enormous credibility problem. Yeah. And if it's a man, if a man is God, then why can't you shoot him? He's dead already, so God is dead. That's even more logical. Let me tell you. Part of the reason why you're saying that is because we live in a Christian country, and the culture we live in has affected us. I always get a kick out of when a young man comes over to me and says, "Rabbi, I'm not so religious, but I'm culturally very Jewish." And he's sitting there with an Armani suit, you know, and he's listening to the Rolling Stones or something, and he's culturally Jewish. I mean, one thing that you and I are not are culturally Jewish. We look very little, in terms of the way we dress, the kind of entertainment we enjoy, is very little Jewish. It's very Christian. It's very Western. It has nothing to do with the Jewish people. If you look, even if you look at the statements of Christianity, let's look at what they believe. I think you mentioned the Trinity. What they say is that there is one God. Christians can't say there's more than one God. But there's a very big problem. The very big problem, and that is that nowhere in the New Testament does Jesus say he's God. Primitive Christianity didn't believe in any Trinity. But they believe within that Godhead there are three persons, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. And they're yet all one. You're telling me that's more logical than believing a bird is God? You see what I'm saying? As a matter of fact, if you read the Nicene Creed, when Rome became Christian, and the first Christian emperor was a man named Constantine, and he goes, the name of the city, but he goes and he forms a council in the year 325, because there was a big argument in the church. Was Jesus God, or was he just a human being? So they have this big conference, and these Catholics are going to decide what Yeshua was, and they finally decide that it's both. He's both fully God, and that's, if you read, it's very interesting. The last page of this document says that Jesus was fully God, and at the same time he was fully human. And repeat it. The Greek word that's used is that he was homoousia, which means of the same substance as the Father, and therefore Jesus was 100% God and 100% man. Not 50% man, 50% God. 100% man, 100% God. And he said, this is such a great mystery that even the angels don't understand it. We can't therefore explain it, and therefore we believe it because it's a mystery. Let me get back. That's where we were. 200% person. It's interesting that most Christians, one of the most common questions I get from Christians is, what translation do you recommend? Which is the best translation? Over and over again. You sometimes wonder why. You need to understand something. Virtually no Christian can read his or her Bible in its original language. Do you understand that? Virtually no Christian in the world, and those few, literally few hundred that can, are professors in universities, can read his New Testament in Greek, in its original Koine Greek, or the Jewish Bible in Hebrew. They cannot. They have no access to it. They are entirely dependent on a translation, and the church made sure of that. The church was always very nervous about the Bible, because as you're going to soon see, that exactly, and therefore the Catholic Church had, for over 1,200 years, quite a number of books that was considered heretical and dangerous to the faith of a Christian to read. And if you're caught reading it, you could be burnt at the stake for it. You know what the number one book that was prohibited by the Catholic Church to read? The Bible. Dangerous book to read, and therefore no Christian can own it or read it. And therefore, if you, anything you study from the Bible, it was only what the priest would teach you. There was one book that you were allowed to own and read. There was one exception to that. Most people wouldn't know that if you guess it, but it's actually Sefer Tehillim. That was the only book that a Christian was allowed to own and read. Because the nature of Sefer Tehillim is that you have not read Tanakh. You had not read Shmuel Aleph. If you didn't read Yeshua Shaftim, you have no idea what Tehillim is talking about. You have no idea what David HaMelech is talking about. If you didn't understand the history of the Jewish people and David HaMelech's own personal life, the Tehillim becomes a very evocative spiritual sefer that certainly could touch your heart, but it won't have really the intellectual meaning unless you understand the background of it. And therefore, it sort of wasn't okay. It was one sefer they allowed them to read. Let me just continue. Part of the reason, I believe, why Jews have an irrational hatred to Christianity or revulsion to Christianity, because our sages tell us that those things that the Jewish people gave their lives for, died for, during a time of persecution, when there would be a time of permissiveness, when the Jews would be allowed to do these things, they would still continue to keep them. The greatest example of that would be Bris Milah. Because the Jewish people risk their lives during periods in our history, during the Hadrian period as a time when the Jews were not allowed to mala their own sons, and they therefore risked their lives to do that. In the same way, because Jews die for Christianity more than any other religion in the world, therefore it literally became a primal aspect of the revulsion to Christianity, that Jews do not want to get involved in it. Yet they do convert, and we're losing tens of thousands. There are today 212 Messianic congregations in the United States. By the way, to give you some sense of growth, 16 years ago there were only 12. I told you there were two conferences on the Jewish people. The one conference, they realized that Christianity has a problem. Jewish people are equating Christianity with persecution. How do they solve that problem? You're Jewish? We love you, L-O-V, love, love, love. That's right, we love you. Because you're Jewish. We love you to death, we love you so much. The second problem they realized they had was a problem that Jews don't want to stop being Jewish. How do they solve this problem? They say, when you're becoming a believer in Jesus, you're not converting to another religion, but on the contrary, you're becoming a completed Jew and a fulfilled Jew. This, by the way, is put out by Jews for Jesus. This is a training manual, how to share the Messiah with the Jew. Remember one rule about Jewish evangelism, and that is that the person that will most likely succeed in converting a Jew is a Gentile evangelical Christian. If you will meet someone in your life who has become, who is converted to these groups, you ask them, who was the very first person that tried to teach you about Christianity? I can assure you, I'll guarantee you, it was a non-Jew. Jews who convert to Christianity are entirely ineffective in converting other Jews. And therefore, these Gentile evangelical Christians have to be taught how to share the Messiah with the Jew. What to say, what not to say. They have to be taught, like, there's all kinds of, this is really good. They have all kinds of juicy things in here, like avoid this, don't do that, avoid Jewish jokes when you're speaking to a Jew. That's a good idea. Here's a good one. When speaking to a Jew, now you have to tell these guys, don't tell me vote for Buchanan, shut up. There's a one over here, letter I. When speaking to a Jew, avoid anti-Semitic terms. Okay. Such as Jewing down, kikes, Christ killers, dirty Jew, Jew boy, etc. It's good advice, don't you think? Don't tell them what you really think of them, keep it to yourself. Inside here, it comes with a card, a communications card, teaching these Gentiles again. You see, I don't know if you can see the top. Can you read what it says on top? It's called the what? A messianic soul winner's card. And under is called the communications card. Right under it, you see what it says? Letter A, what does it say there?
Become as a Jew to the Jews.
Become as a Jew to the Jews. Now here this guy, this guy from Wyoming. He has to become like something that's kind of test. Become as a Jew to the Jews. Why is it important that these guys become as a Jew to the Jews? What do you think, yeah?
Because then the Jews will think that he's Jewish and, oh, maybe this guy's great. That's why.
Okay, okay. Take it. Take me one step further. Yes. Take me a step further. That's very good. Take me one step further. This is what you're saying, yes? What they're saying? Okay, you all saying the same thing, but one more step. They're saying, hey, by becoming a believer in Jesus, are you converting to another religion? No. It's Jewish to believe in Jesus, and therefore you don't have to stop being Jewish, because I want you to know something. I am sure every one of you in this room, and I will include myself in this, we have family that are not as observant as we are, right? We have cousins, uncles, nephews, second cousins, and they're not as committed to their faith as you are. They don't know and understand their Bible. I'm sure some of you are worried about them. Maybe somebody in your family is dating someone who's not Jewish, and it hurts you. But I will tell you this, that those people in your family, those that you know personally, who are not observant, who are not as committed as you are, they don't want to stop being Jewish. This is very important to understand. Most Jews are very proud to be Jewish. They take a lot of pride in their Jewish heritage and so on. And they don't want to become a Gentile. They don't want to stop being Jewish. And therefore, the purpose of this all is to say to them, hey, you don't have to convert to another religion. No, you become, well, watch this. This communications card has two columns on it. One column says, don't say, and the other column says, all right, good. So let me just go through a few of the don't say's and do say's so you have an idea of how this works. For instance, on the list it says, don't say to a Jew, Jesus Christ, that's M. Do say, the Messiah Yeshua. Isn't that special? Okay. Don't say to a Jew, convert. Jews, they don't want to convert. Do say, become a Messianic Jew. That's nice. Go into, don't go, but if you went into a Messianic congregation, by the way, there are no crosses anywhere. There's an Aron HaKodesh in the front of the sanctuary. There's a Messianic rabbi there, not a Messianic priest. He's got a yarmulke on his head, sits at the door on the side of his trousers. By the way, any of you know is a great trick. Any of you know how to tell a Messianic tzitzis? Messianic tzitzis. Any of you know how to tell? Sorry? No? They have no strings, which is air. You can't see it because it has no strings. But it's a thing. How do you? The way you can tell messianic tzitzis is the tzitzis are connected to the belt loops. There's no beged. It's simply connected to the belt loops. It's sort of indicative of the movement. Outwardly it looks Jewish, but open the shirt, there's nothing inside. Don't call yourself a Christian. Do say, I'm a Bible believer. The next one's a doozy. Don't say to a Jew, go to church. Jews don't want to go to church. They don't even want to go to shul. I can't even go to church. They're going to be up for Shabbos in the morning again. Do say, come to a meeting of Bible believers. That's much better. Don't call it the New Testament. Call it the New Covenant, the Brit Hadashah. Don't call it a cross, call it a tree or a stake. I have no idea what this means. They don't celebrate Christian holidays. They celebrate Jewish holidays. I'll pass this around to you. I brought along with me a couple of these. Messianic Passover. If you look at it yourself. You can see it. If you went to a Messianic Seder, the table set up just the way your table is, pretty much. They may not have the Chazonish Haggadah there, but the service is rendered a little differently. They will tell you that the wine, oh yes, the wine represents the blood of Jesus, and the matzah represents the body of Jesus. And do you know the reason? I bet you can guess the real reason why Jews have 3 matzah at the Seder table. You want to guess why? Represent the Holy Trinity, Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost. Very good. And do you know why the matzahs are perforated? You know why the matzahs have holes in them? Because Jesus was perforated, he had holes in him. I have no idea what this means either. Do you know why the matzahs have stripes going up and down? Because Jesus had stripes. You know why the middle matzah is broken? Because Jesus was broken. You know why the middle matzah is wrapped in a white shmata? You guessed it. That's right, because Jesus was wrapped in a white shmata too. And do you know why that matzah is hidden beneath the Father? Because Jesus was hidden away in the tomb. You know why the matzah of the Afikam is brought back at the end of the Seder? Because Jesus will return. Exactly. They don't teach you anything here, Rabbi. They don't teach you this stuff. What kind of education do you give me here? Alright. There was a great sage. His name was the Duvna Magid. I'm sure many of you have heard of him. And Duvna Magid was well known for teaching information, sometimes complex information, through a parable. And he tells a story, a very interesting story, of a young prince, probably no older than you, who one day decided that he wanted to take a walk in the forest that he had never walked in before, outside of his father's palace. And as he's walking in the forest, he notices on a tree that there's an archer's target there. You know what an archer's target looks like? It's a round. And someone had been there, exactly, and there was a bullseye, meaning that someone had been there, and they shot an arrow into this archer's target, and the arrow that landed was a perfect bullseye. It actually landed right in the center of the center circle. And the prince was very concerned, very curious. Who is this person? Perfect bullseye right smack in the middle. But he keeps walking and comes to the second tree. And guess what he finds on the second tree? Same thing. Archer's target. Someone a bit there. Perfect bullseye. Not just hitting the red circle, but the center of the red circle. And now his curiosity was really becoming heightened. Who is this person? Two in a row, perfect. I mean, he goes to the third tree, and again, perfect bullseye. Duvna Magid tells the story that he goes to the 10th tree, all the other 9 perfect bullseyes, but this time, he sees this big fat fellow standing beneath the tree with a bow in his hand. The prince runs over to him immediately and says, "Excuse me, sir, are you the one that shot all these 10 shots, perfect bullseyes?" And the man said, "I am." He said, "You're the best archer I have ever met in my life. No one of my father's little crack archers, you know, could shoot that well." And the man begins to laugh hysterically. And the prince is very agitated. He says, "Why are you laughing?" And the fat man says to the prince, "Let me tell you how I do it. The first thing I do is I shoot an arrow into a tree, and then I paint a target around it." Listen carefully. Christian Christianity, as I mentioned earlier, didn't start in a vacuum, and therefore it has an enormous problem. It has to prove itself from Judaism. The person they claim is the Messiah, the idea of a Messiah is well known amongst the Jewish people, and Tanakh speaks about the Mashiach over and over again, constantly, particularly in the Nevi'im Achronim, particularly once the Jewish people say, we want to have a king. Once the Jews make the conscious decision that we want a king, a human king, then we have the concept of a personal physical Messiah, that it's introduced into Tanakh in the most explicit ways. Sefer Yecheskel, the whole end of Sefer Yecheskel, the description of Mashiach, about the description of the end time world, what the third temple will look like. Did you know that? Did you learn Yecheskel? Did you learn Yecheskel? From chapter 40 to 48 is a description of what the third temple will look like. How many windows it'll have, how large it'll be, how tall it'll be, how many, exactly what it will look like. And therefore, in order for Christianity, in order for the founding church fathers to prove Christianity, they had to do two things. The first thing they had to do was they had to alter the words of Tanakh to make them appear as if they're speaking about Jesus. And they also had to alter Jesus' life to make it sound like it's speaking, it refers to words, it fulfills the messianic parameters found in the Jewish scriptures, found in Tanakh. We do not have a lot of time here today. We don't have a lot of time here. That means I don't have enough time to take you through a journey of every single verse that missionaries use in order to convert people to Christianity and say, I can prove to you from Tanakh. We don't have the time. But in a very short time that we have today, what I'd like to do with you is take you on a journey that you've never been on before, I would imagine. And that is, we're going to examine the techniques the church used in order to alter the Jewish scriptures to make it appear Christological. Okay? Let me give you, now, the first technique we're going to examine today is a technique called taking a verse out of context. Taking a verse out of context. Now, what do I mean by that? What I'd like to do is, I'd like to give you an example of what I mean by that. This is so important because of all the methods the church has used to change the Jewish Bible, this one is most pervasive. Every single text that the church uses, that Jews for Jesus will quote in their tracts that they give out in New York. Ever see that, Jews for Jesus missionaries in New York? Every single one of the verses they use has been taken out of context. Now, what I want to do with you is I want to give you an example of what I mean by take a verse out of context, so you will know what I mean by that. Let me give you an example. Right in the beginning of the Christian Bible, the New Testament, the book of Matthew, which is the first book in the New Testament, there are 27 books in the New Testament. Matthew is the first one that appears there. Matthew tells us that when Jesus was a little child, Herod the Great finds out that a little boy was born in Bethlehem was going to be king of the Jews. And Herod the Great wanted to kill this boy because he was king and he wanted someone else to become king. And therefore, this little boy was in a lot of trouble. I'm going to put up the caution light right now for you. Warning. That is, the New Testament disagrees on when Jesus was born. Although Matthew tells us that Jesus was born before Herod the Great was dead. By the way, Herod, any of you heard of Herod the Great? Herod, right? Okay. Now, Herod died in the year 4 BCE. Herod died in the year 4 BCE. When you go to Eretz Yisrael and you see the stones, where the border of the stones are receded into the stone, those are Herodian stones. Therefore, you would see them on the Kaisel, you would see them on Marasat Machpelah, as an example. Those are Herodian stones. Herod died in the year 4 BCE. Therefore, according to Matthew, Jesus was born around the year 6 or 7 BCE. So he was about 3 years old when Herod is dead. Now, Luke is the third book in the New Testament. And this is something you have to remember, that is, no two books in the New Testament agree on anything about Jesus' life. In the book of Luke, Jesus was born at the time of a Roman census of its citizens. Like, you know, the United States, they did a census where they, a number of years ago, they wanted to know how many people live in the United States, who they were, how much money they earned, where they lived, what kind of households they have. Well, the Romans wanted to do that too for taxation, and a man named Curianus, who was the governor of that time, of that period, in the year 6 CE, has this census of the Roman Empire. And Luke says that's when Jesus was born. So according to Matthew, Jesus was born in the year about 6 BCE. According to Luke, he's born in the year about 6 CE. Like a machlokes, you know, go ahead, yes.
Isn't the year zero, the time when he
dies? Okay. Isn't the year zero the time when he dies? No. First of all, there's no such thing as the year zero. There would be only the year one. That would also, according to Christianity, that's when he was born. Number three, this whole notion of, let's say we're in the year 1996. Okay? Who came up with that? Okay, what did this come up with? Actually, it's a 6th century monk whose name is Damasius Exiguus. That's his name. In Latin, that's roughly translated Danny the Dwarf. He said, he made his cheshbonis, and he said that Jesus was born in the year what? Now, to be honest with you, from a Christian position, he did pretty good. That means if you lived in the 6th century, you understand, living in the 6th century, it was a bad time to live. If you had a choice, when you're going to live, you don't want to live in the 6th, 7th, 8th century, the bad times. Was it not? The world was pretty dark at that point. I mean, the lights went out pretty much in the world. And, of course, that was a great period for Jewish history and Jewish wisdom. But the world itself, the lights sort of went out at that period. So here's a guy writing at a pretty bad time in world history, and he's doing a pretty good job, but he's off. Even, you know, Kuli Alma Loi Pligi, everyone agrees that he's off there, but he gets close. They said he's about 6 years off from Luke and Matthew. He couldn't get both because they don't agree with each other. There is not one event in the New Testament where any two books agree on what happened. Even fundamental issues, what day was Jesus crucified on? Er Pesach, the first day of Pesach, who was there in the tomb, how many people were there in the tomb, when did they come? There's no agreement on anything. Okay? So what we're doing is, now you can begin to understand why the Catholic Church found it so threatening to allow Catholic parishioners to read the Bible. It was considered dangerous to your faith, because if you read it, it would create a very serious problem. And although Protestants pride themselves, they now allow their parishioners to read the Bible, they will never teach a Christian boy Greek. It doesn't exist. Means we, a little child, goes to yeshiva already, learning Hebrew, learning Aleph Beis. Christian children go to Christian schools, they're not learning Greek. They never learn Greek. They may take it in college for one or two semesters, but that they really never learn it. So it's basically a closed book. They cannot read their Bible in its original language. So now what happens is, according to Matthew, we have this little story we're told. Herod is told that this boy born in Bethlehem, he's going to be the king of the Jews, and therefore Herod wants to kill the boy. So the New Testament says that an angel comes to Joseph, Mary's cousin, Mary's husband, right? And says to Joseph, hey, Jesus is in a lot of trouble. Quick, let's get him out of here because Herod wants to kill him. So Joseph takes Mary and the baby and they go run to Egypt, which was outside, supposedly, of the jurisdiction of Herod. Is that an arbitrary event in the Mashiach's life that little Mashiach has to be brought to Egypt? Oh, no. Matthew wants you to know that this is not arbitrary at all. Don't you know that your own Jewish Bible foretold the Mashiach as a little baby had to go to Egypt? Did you know that? So Matthew is going to show us from Tanakh, from the Jewish prophets, that they foretold that the Messiah, as a child, had to go to Egypt. Okay? Is there anyone here who does not understand this, what I just told you? If you don't understand, raise your hand and I'll explain to you. It's very important you understand. It's a very simple story. Yes? You want me to repeat what I said again? Okay. Matthew tells us a very simple story. When Jesus was just a little boy, Herod wants to kill him because Herod doesn't like competition. So Joseph, Mary's husband, has a dream. In the dream, an angel comes to him and says, take little Jesus, go to Egypt, and be there until I give you word, because Herod is looking to kill the kid. So Joseph takes Mary and little Jesus and they go to Egypt and were there until Herod dies. Okay? And this is the philopusik of Tanakh. And you're going to, Matthew is now going to quote the pasuk from Tanakh. Let's take a look. I'd like you to look at the first page of your of this handout. Look at the upper left-hand corner. If we couldn't wait to the end, I'd appreciate it. Matthew chapter 2, verse 13. Matthew, let's look inside. And when they were departed, behold, the angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream, saying, arise and take the young child and his mother and flee into Egypt, and be thou there until I bring thee word, for Herod will seek the young child to destroy him. Verse 14. When he arose, he took the young child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt, and was there until the death of Herod, that it might be fulfilled. And here is the pasuk in the quote. And it was there until the death of Herod that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken of the Lord by the prophet, saying, out of Egypt have I called my son. The part you see there in quotation marks, that's bold and italics, that's the quote that Matthew is telling us. Comes from Tanakh, out of Egypt have I called my son. So here we have a Beferish pasuk in Tanakh, which says that out of Egypt have I called my son. So we see clearly that the Mashiach, as a little baby, is supposed to go to Egypt. Okay? Now I want you to know that this verse does exist in Tanakh. It does. Kavsam Sefer Hosea, the book of Hosea. Hosea. The only thing is I'm going to caution you, and that is tell you something that might surprise you. Matthew only quotes half of this verse. Matthew only quotes half of this original pasuk in Tanakh. And the question, of course, becomes is why? Why would Matthew see it as very important that only half of the original pasuk would be quoted? And the answer is very simple. Matthew had no choice, because if Matthew would have quoted the pasuk from Tanakh in its entirety, it would become absolutely clear to anyone reading this Christian Bible that Hosea was not referring to the Mashiach at all, but was referring to something else entirely. Take a look. Now, I've done the homework for you. If you had a Christian study Bible, it would tell you that you can find this verse in Hosea chapter 11, verse 1. Well, let's take a look at this pasuk in its entirety. When Israel was a child, then I loved him and called my son out of Egypt. Is that pasuk referring to the Mashiach? No. What is it referring to? Point to B'nai Yisrael. What did Matthew do? He simply snipped the verse in half. He took the last clause of the verse and quoted that alone. And therefore, all you have is the last section of the verse, then you might think that this is referring to, I don't know, some kid. By the way, remember, Matthew is using this, another interesting point here. If Matthew is using this to show how Jesus' little boy has to go to Egypt, right? But by the way, look at Hosea one more time. Is that pasuk referring to an entrance into Egypt, or really an exodus from Egypt? As an exodus. So it's actually completely misapplied. Now, this is the first technique. Simply take a verse out of context. What he did was a very simple thing. Simply quoted half the verse, and by doing that, the reader of the New Testament has no idea what it actually says in Hosea. When we look at the original comment, we see that it's not referring to the Mashiach, it's actually referring to Klal Yisrael. It's not referring to anyone going into Egypt, it's referring to a whole nation exiting from Egypt. Is anyone here who does not understand what I just said? Yes?
Yeah, because if you come out of Egypt, you have to be in Egypt.
Therefore?
Therefore,
if he's not saying anything about another part of history, he's saying that Jesus going into Egypt is prophesied by Hosea.
Well, but it implies it though, because if you have to Egypt, it says you have to go into Egypt.
You don't have to come out of Egypt to go in. He went into Egypt. He's saying this is the proof of some apostasy. You're saying if you go out of Egypt, you have to go into Egypt. That's very good, but you don't have to come out of Egypt to go into Egypt. Yes.
Why,
Wow, that's a really good question. That's a really excellent question. You have a very, very good mind. Very good mind. The question is, can't they say, well, we have a Teresh Valtei here, and even though they might say like this, even though it's clearly talking about Klal Yisrael, but they can say it's a picture of the Mashiach, right? Okay, very good question. There are a number of problems with this, but it's a very good question. Your mind is very keen. Problem number one is Christians don't believe in the Torah Sheba'al Peh. Problem number two gets even greater, and that is verse 2 describes Klal Yisrael as the children of Israel in verse 1, when Israel was a child, as those that have sinned and worshipped idolatry. So this one cannot be a picture of the Messiah itself. 3 is you can't build doctrine on a homily. Let me explain to you what I mean by that. We have a national revelation at Sinai. They have no national revelation. The whole nation heard God's voice at Sinai. No other nation ever made the claim of a national revelation. Our national revelation said we should keep Shabbos. We should believe in one God and there is no other. You want to change that? Where is your national revelation for it? Where is your proof for it? We are muhzaki, meaning you have to prove it. What Matthew is trying to do, very cute, but what Matthew is trying to do is he's trying to prove Christianity. He's saying to you, I can prove to you Jesus is the Messiah from the Jewish scriptures. Now, you show me a verse, and this is your proof, and that verse clearly has been removed from context. Of course, the question of Matthew is, why didn't you quote the whole verse then? What were you so afraid of? But the point is, when you're trying to prove Christianity, you can't prove Christianity from a homily. You have to prove it from the literal text. Everybody knows, which means that the plain understanding of meaning is exactly what it says in the original text. You can't prove a Christian doctrine from a homily, from some vertical, that it means like this. But of course, if you look at it in context, and you think clearly, this could never be a picture of a Christianity says with God name. But that was very good thinking. Yes?
Jesus, according to them, is the Messiah, and why did he die?
Okay. The question is, if he's the Messiah, why did he die? That's an excellent question, and really, they can't answer it. But they can. This is the question I have to give you, and that is that Christianity uses the term Messiah, Judaism uses the term Messiah, we spell the word the same way, it sounds the same way, we mean two entirely different things. Do you think it's a coincidence that Buddha and Krishna were both born on December 25th from virgins? Tammuz, the vegetation god of Babylon, also was born on from a virgin on December 25th. So was Isis, the sun god, and all of you have heard of Hercules. Well, guess what? He was born of a virgin too. The idea of being born of a virgin, particularly on December 25th, which is called solstice, that was a Roman holiday. That's what December 25th is. Why is December 25th, why did the pagan world consider December 25th to be a holiday? Anyone know? Why?
It's the equinox.
What does that mean?
It's the changing of the harvest season.
So what? So you change it four times. You're changing seasons four times. Why is that season?
You have the beginning of the their. It's,
you're right.
They were worshiping part of the culture was very agricultural, and therefore the religion is based around that.
Okay, good.
But what I want to know is how does September 25th become December 25th?
Did I say September?
Yes.
I apologize. December 25th. I said September.
Okay,
I said December. 27th is very crucial because what's the shortest day of the year? What's the shortest day of the year? December what? 21st. Now, if you worship the sun, S-U-N, and suddenly you see the sun every day coming out less and less and less, there's a fear that it's going to be gone. So what these sun worshippers used to do is used to watch the sun, they pray to it, they worshipped it. And every day suddenly the sun is spending less and less time out there. And when it came to the 21st, oh my God, that was the shortest day. At least the sun is never exposed for less time than December 21st. And then of course these sun worshippers had enormous fear that perhaps it would keep diminishing until it was completely gone. But then suddenly something happened, that was on the 22nd, just a little bit more suddenly, it started to spin a little more. And they had a chazakah by the 25th day, the gemud, they knew that it was time for coming back. So by the 25th, when they saw the 22nd, 23rd and 24th, and it come back for 3 days, and it was getting warmer, then it was confirmed, and it was coming back. So the 25th was the day these sun worshippers would then have an enormous holiday. This was called solstice. And of course, Christianity simply inherited this. I have no idea why, how I went into this. But anyway, how did I go into this? Someone asked me a question, and I went into
this. This is how I happened to be
there. Ah, right. So understand that in these religions, the idea of a person defying death in the pagan world was fantastic. The notion that their God-man would be born of a virgin and defy death was something incredible. And by the way, virtually all of the gods of the Greco-Roman Empire did this. And because Christianity, although it started amongst Jews as a Jewish heresy, it quickly emerged into the Gentile world. And in the Gentile world, they had to constantly infuse into it things that they could relate to. Let me move on, because our time is getting very limited now. What time do I have now? How much time do I have left? 20 minutes. I'm going to move really quickly. I want you to turn the page for a moment, please. I want to read to you a verse as it appears. I want to read a verse to you as it appears in a Jewish translation. We're interested in Psalm 22, verse 17, one caution. In the Christian Bible, this verse appears as verse 16. That happens very often in Tehillim. That means what we consider verse 17 is in the Christian Bible verse 16. I'm not going to get into how that works. What they really do is that the opening verse, Mizmor LeDavid, they don't consider that a pasuk at all. That's like the heading. So when they start verse 1, is by us already verse 2. So Psalm 22, 17 in the Jewish Bible is Psalm 22, 16, Lehavdil, in the Christian Bible. I want to read to you this pasuk as it appears in a Jewish Bible. The translation is in the upper right-hand corner. This happens to come from San Sino Press. This is their translation. For dogs have encompassed me, a company of evildoers have enclosed me, like a lion they're at my hands and my feet. Who is that talking about? Probably dealing with shoes, they know too much. Let's go to the left side of the page. I want to read to you this verse as it appears in a Christian Bible. Read it along with me very carefully. Psalm 22, 16, same verse. For dogs have compassed me, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me, they pierced my hands and my feet. Be honest now. Who does that sound like it might be speaking about? All right. Now, what is it with you? First time I read it, you're not sure. Two of you say David. The second time I read it, everyone says it sounds like it's speaking about Jesus. Now, what is it about when I read to you that same exact verse the second time made you think it sounded like it's speaking about Jesus? Yes. Pierced. The word pierced sounds really Christological. Pierced my hands and my feet. Whoa, that sounds like Jesus. Now, what I've done for you, by the way, is I gave you the Hebrew on the right side. Do any of you see the word pierced in the word Hebrew, in Hebrew there? Okay. Do any of you see the Hebrew word that the church changed to read pierced? What word is that? And what does the word ka'ari mean? Yeah, ka'ari means like line. It doesn't mean pierced. You simply change one word in the verse and suddenly you have a new message. Hey, hold on. What's your first name?
Solomon.
Wait one second. How do you know the word Kari means like a lion? It means pierced, but the rabbis didn't want you to believe in Jesus, so they changed it to mean like a lion. Could you prove it to me? I'm a missionary.
Yes.
Prove it to me. He's so serious. I love it. Could you think of an objective? He's great. He's going to be a big issue one day. Could you think of a technique where you can prove to some... That means, listen very carefully. I want you to turn up the brain now, because I need you to be really sharp here. Could any of you think of a technique that you can prove, use to prove to someone who doesn't understand Hebrew, who's telling someone's lying, someone's telling you, how would you prove it? Someone who doesn't understand Hebrew, yes.
We're the ones that have learned Hebrew, whereas the other people.
Okay, good. Let's get another. That's a little subjective. You're right. We're the ones who touch Hebrew. As a matter of fact, Jerome, we did the book, and I spent 22 years in Eretz Yisrael learning with more than Hanoi, about more than Amoraim, Hebrew in order to write the book. But that's a good way. But they can say, well, the rabbis didn't want you to believe in Jesus, so they switched. Some of the rabbis don't understand. They do understand Hebrew, but they're so demonic that they wouldn't even believe in Jesus, so they changed it. How would you prove objectively, empirically, to someone who's a Christian, doesn't understand Hebrew, who's lying? You. He's delicious. Better than not fit in.
Oh,
I thought,
All right, good. I give you more delicious. So head one for the S. Not in Testament. Bingo. Don't you think the word Ka'ari, listen carefully, I'll show you this. Don't you think the word Ka'ari appears in other places in Tanakh? There are more than 30,000 verses, sukkim, in Tanakh. Don't you think the word Ka'ari appears in other places in Tanakh? Yes. By the way, it appears how many times in Tanakh? How many?
72.
What is an auction over here?
346.
No point guessing. 91 times. This is one of them, which means this word appears in 90 other places in Tanakh. Do any of you want to venture to guess how these Christian Bibles translate that exact same word in all of the 90 places?
They don't.
Like
a line.
Like a line, exactly. Only here do they translate it as pierced. Take a look over there. You've seen, actually, I give you one other example, section C, Isaiah 38:13. You see it there, a little down the same page? We see it, Isaiah took another sefer. Shivisi Hashem, what am I saying, Shivisi Hashem? Shivisi Adboker Ka'ari. King James, I reckon till morning that as a lion. That's the King James. Why does Ka'ari in Isaiah 38:13 mean like a lion? But somehow in Psalm 22 it means pierced. What I want to do is this. I want to finish what I have to do, then I'm going to take your questions. Let me do it because we don't, our time is, I blew away a lot of time here. I didn't realize how much time we were moving in. Let me, by the way, if anyone would even take out a minute to look at Psalm 22, you'd see instantly the absurdity of it, because David HaMelech is speaking, you're right, and he's speaking in the first person about himself, and he's constantly using the animal motif to describe his enemies. As a matter of fact, the word lion appears a number of times in Tehillim. It never means a lion who you and I think of, but it's always metaphoric. The lion represents his enemies, like Shaul, his predecessor, and like his son who wanted to kill him, and so on. And he, if you look right before in rows B, you'll see there that right before verse 16, and right after verse 16, he's talking about lions and dogs who are trying to destroy him. So now those words somehow mean lions and not pierced anymore. One more example. Remember a moment ago, so that's technique number two. You change one word in the verse, and suddenly you have a brand new message. Let me show you one other technique. Now, remember earlier we said that little Jesus had to go to Egypt, right, to get out of the way of Herod? Well, the New Testament continues and says, hey, Herod dies, and now Yashkara, the little boy, can go back to Israel. According to the New Testament, according to Christian theology, what city was Jesus born in, by the way?
Bethlehem.
Goes to Egypt, but when he comes back from Egypt, does he go back to the city of Bethlehem? No. Where does he go then? This is a flatbush over here. Don't stop me. No, he goes to Nazareth. By the way, guys, is that an accident? Don't you know that your Jewish Bible says that the Messiah would be a resident of the city of Nazareth? You didn't know that? What did they learn here? Nothing? Take a look at the bottom of the page. We're going to take questions at the end if we have time. Same page, don't have to turn it. You turn your back when we start doing. Stay here. Bottom of the page. We're in Matthew, but instead of being 2:13 through 50, we're now in verse 23. A little further on in this chapter. And now he tells us that he comes back to see Nazareth and fulfilled the Pasuk in Tanakh. And he came and dwelt in a city called Nazareth, that it might be fulfilled which is spoken by the prophets. And here's the quote. He shall be called a Nazarene. Very simple pasuk. Do you learn Bache, by the way? Does anyone know? All right. You know this. We'll see if you know this stuff. Does anyone here know which sefer this comes from?
If you don't know, it's not a big deal. Because I don't know if how much you learned enough. If you know it, go ahead. What? What'd you say? No, not Shaitan. You. Somebody else? Yeah? Shmuel? Shmuel, he's good. No. Someone? Really? You guys don't know? How much Navi did you learn? See, the girls usually know this stuff because they learn more Navi. Yes?
Oh, it's not related.
Gentlemen? Listen carefully. Don't feel bad for not knowing. Technique number three is, it's not written anywhere, it doesn't exist. You were right. Technique number three is it doesn't exist, and if the church didn't have a verse to prove its position, it simply invented a verse that simply does not exist. There is no such pasuk anywhere in Tanakh. By the way, how many times does the city of Nazareth appear in Tanakh? Anyone know? Zero. So not only doesn't this pasuk appear anywhere, the city of Nazareth never appears anywhere in Tanakh. Doesn't appear anywhere in the Gemara either. Never appears anywhere. If you don't have a verse, you simply invent it. Okay. Now I will take questions. Yes.
First of all, when you said that Kohari, why did you say that? Because many times you have different translations of the same word.
Right. So what we'd want to do is we would expect, if they're telling the truth, we'd expect to see that somewhere else in one of the 90 other places. The other thing is that the words, when you say to a word that has a number of meaning, it's because they share a shoresh, right? The word yaskil means to become intelligent, but it also means to prosper. The word lispalel means to, lispalel means to pray, but it really means to cause yourself to think. There is a basis and a root. There is none at all. And again, we would expect to see that in another place in the Bible. Moreover, when we see the context, then we know for sure that something's not going to do. Yes.
Correct. It's not a verb. Kari.
Right. Exactly. It's not. Very good. Very well. You had a second follow up on that one?
Yeah, not really a follow up.
Okay. Go ahead.
You said in the beginning that in, you know, from, you know, Zion, that,
yes,
that we'll always be small. So how come it says in other places, many other places, that we'll be like the sand of the sea? And the
so then if you look at the Tacha, it says, whereas you could have been as large as the sand of the sea, but because you disregarded me, because you abandoned my message, therefore you're going to be very few in number. Yes?
If Christianity is not based on logic, how can we prove them wrong logically?
That's what we were just doing here.
No, I'm saying no. We can prove their proofs wrong. But we can't show that their actual religion is true. If it's not based on logic, their whole system is not based on logic, say God is three parts.
But they claim that it is based on logic. They claim you can prove it.
They don't say we're illogical.
They don't say we're illogical, they say we're illogical.
No, they're illogical. Don't they say that God is illogical?
No, they say it is logical. By the way, when they say that there are things that are mysterious, you understand, we can allow for things to be mysterious, but we can't allow for contradiction. I'll tell you a very interesting thing that happened to me. I was speaking at Duke University. They have a very large, they have a divinity school there. And I was asked to give a lecture there on a different topic. And when I got in there and I looked in there, don't ask me how I could tell, but I could tell there wasn't a Jew in the audience. It was, I don't know, a couple hundred people, and they were all going. So I thought I'd have a very interesting time with them. I asked them this question. Listen carefully. I asked them, tell me something. If there really is no Trinity, but there's only one God and no other God but one, right? What would God, or what should God have written in the Tanakh, in Tanakh? What would you need to see in Tanakh to demonstrate that to you? What would God have written so that everyone would know that there's only a unity of God, there's only one God, and there isn't a Trinity? What would you need to see? Now I'm not asking you that question. I asked them that question. It would be meaningful if I asked you. I asked them, tell me, what would you need, what should God have written in order to convince mankind that there is one God, there is no other, there is no multiple person, one God, and that's it. So suddenly a hand rose up in the air, and he said, well, I would like to see this, what it should say. I said, yes, and I went to the blackboard, and I wrote down what he said. Then another hand went up, and he said, well, it should say this and this and this, and that's how we know, and I wrote it down. I think we had, I don't remember, 8 or 10 verse things that people said. If it said this, that's how God should have communicated. That's how I would know there's one God and no other. And I asked, are you finished? And no other hands went up, and I said, watch this. I took the chalk, and I went up next to every statement, I put a verse down next to it. You got the message? Do you understand? Yes.
Before, when you said about the something that's Christian, it was like scary, and they thought it was more than God, to bring them up. It was Christian, and there are times
guys, please, it's not respectful.
But Christianity, they say that God can save you already, that you're not the one nation. There are conflicts. And with Buddhism, it's just that you want to go like a flower, and there's no difference. So there's no conflict.
I will, so you asking this question?
What might we do with
you? No. When you said that, why?
Just tell me your choice. I don't know how to listen to you.
It's
this is a question?
Answer.
All right, do me a favor, because we only have like a minute or two left.
Well,
can you listen to the question?
Christianity.
bothered you more so than we can bring it
right. I'm suggesting the reason why it bothers us irrationally is, and we can see that there's something there that is mysterious and miraculous. And it really is that essence. I didn't see this written anywhere, but I believe this because Jews, more than any other faith, gave their lives not to convert to Christianity and died al kiddush Hashem not to be a Christian, right? So therefore, because now, today, we can be Jews in the United States, it's never been easier to be an Orthodox Jew. In a sense, it's never been more difficult psychologically, but in terms of practical sense, it's never been easier. We're not just tolerated here, we're part of the fabric. Yeah, so that's why it's irrational. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you said before about the stars that was no margin of error that were announced in
yes.
the world, and that Hashem said it would be like the stars sky across the earth. Why would Hashem tell us that we would be those like the stars?
Well, that's because there is an end to this. And that is, the Bible tells us at the end of days. There are message, first of all, would be an incredible ingathering. You know, I'm only going to be here for another 2 minutes, so stay with me. I mean, these questions are phenomenal. I want to just bring this all together for you. We see, for instance, in Sefer Yechezkel, that at the end of the day, there's going to be an incredible ingathering. I mean, we have lost many, many Jews. According to secular chronology, not our chronology, but according to secular chronology, in the year 722 BCE, we lost the vast bulk of the Jewish people. They were carried off. They were carried off by Sancheirev, what is probably today northern Turkey, although maybe 100% further. But there's a promise that they are going to be ingathered, they're going to be brought back. There are many Jewish people that have been lost. You know, during the first century, during the Christian era, there were 4 million Jews in the world. Out of a Roman Empire that was 44 million, meaning we were 9% of the Roman Empire. Had we maintained that slice of the pie, world population, we should be about 600 million Jews in the world today. We're not, we're only 12 million. What happened to the rest of those Jewish people? Many Jewish people fell away. The promise of the Messianic Age is an incredible ingathering and a restoration of the Jewish people. But, you know, one of the very painful facts of Jewish history is the Jewish people had a potential to be much larger in number. But, you see, although there's a covenant that God made with Abraham that we would be an eternal nation, only the nation has that guarantee. No individual Jew has the guarantee of the covenant. Meaning that when we do Kiruv, when we try to bring Jewish people to make them more observant, we're not doing that because we're afraid we might disappear. We don't bring get Jews to become religious. The Jews cannot disappear. It's interesting, the one mitzvah that the Jewish people invented was to maintain Jewish continuity. There is no such mitzvah. That's God's mitzvah. That's his problem, not my problem. Hashem has a promise that we will be an eternal nation and nothing could happen to the nation, to corporate Israel. But no individual Jew has that guarantee. So the nation had the potential to be a huge number. But what happens is, and remember I told you Deuteronomy 7:7? Well, two verses later, verse 9, goes like this. I will give my covenant for two things. To those who love me and keep my mitzvot. It's repeated again in verse 12. So the condition on the covenant, and that is those who love me and keep my Torah. There are about 127 generations from Har Sinai until today. And I will tell you that most Jews actually opted out of the message. Most Jews, friends, you will not meet. Reform movement began in the beginning of the 1800s, right? Very proud to be Jews, but they were Reform Jews. Many of them came to the United States in the 1800s, before the great immigration from, let's say, 1820 to 1860 and 1880, had a large German immigration. Where are their grandchildren today? Why don't you meet Reform Jews who are the great-great-grandchildren of other Reform Jews? They've been lost. They've assimilated out. And by the way, the Reform movement then was much more conservative than it is now. Reform rabbis then were not performing intermarriages yet. They weren't, you know, and all these things. They didn't have these fantastic innovations yet. So understand that the covenant is very conditional, and it's up to us. The nation could have been very, very large in number,
But what happens is most of the Jews opt out of the message. The reason why the Jewish people have to be an eternal nation is because we have an eternal message to bring to the world. By the way, isn't it interesting that the only Jews that have ever been preserved throughout Jewish history are those Jews that kept Torah Shabbat Shalom and Torah Shema Peh? Most Jews said, we don't believe in this. Most Jews actually opted out. They became Karoyim, Sadducees, Christians. The question you might want to ask is this. If Christianity is true, why did God never preserve those Jews who believed in Christianity, who converted to Christianity? If Islam is true, why did God preserve those Jews who became Muslims? Why did God only preserve those Jews who rejected Christianity, rejected Islam, rejected the Karaite movement, rejected the Sadducee movement, rejected atheism? The only nation, the only remnant of the nation, if you follow the bouncing ball, the only stream of Jews that have ever been preserved are those Jews who rejected all the religions and embraced the written and oral Torah. If you want to know about the Karaites today, you've got to read about them in libraries. The Sadducees, they didn't write anything. You've got to read what others wrote about them. They're gone. You don't have any in your family. What happened to them? They don't have a covenant because they opted out of the message of Torah. We'll probably have to end just about now. Do I have 2 minutes?
2 minutes.
I mean, you can put your hands down, and I'll be here afterwards if you want to ask me a question privately. I want to share one interesting point with you. Did you happen to notice that if you study world religions, you'll notice that all the world religions that predate the destruction of the Second Temple, and this really gets back to what so many of you were talking about today, the religions that predated the destruction of the Second Temple, meaning the year 70, are extremely dissimilar to Judaism, like Buddhism, like Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, and all the world religions that come after the destruction of the Second Temple are not only similar to Judaism, but are based on Judaism. Question is why? What is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's plan? What is the plan for Christianity? What is the purpose in all this? I want to share something with you that I think is very valuable. The most important messianic prophecy, the most important thing that's going to happen when Mashiach comes, is the universal knowledge of God. Meaning that all the nations, instantly, when Mashiach comes, will instantly recognize the error, and they were all going to point to the Jewish people and say, now we know that what you are teaching is true. In Zechariah chapter 8, verse 23, Zechariah, Perches, last pasuk in the Tzerek, it says that 10 Gentiles of different languages will grab the shirt of a Jew and say, take us with you, because now we know God is with you. By the way, if Islam is true, why would the going to be coming to the Jews? We should be going to the Arabs. Christianity is true, why shouldn't we be? No, all the nations are going to come to the Jews. Now, do you ever wonder how is that going to happen? I mean, are they going to become programmed? Are people's brains going to change? I mean, how might this occur? Remember I asked you earlier on this afternoon, 1 hour before Jesus was born, if you asked any Christian who had the truth, they would have to say the Jews. Every Christian in the world would have to say it. If I asked any Christian today, if Christianity is false, who has the truth? What would they have to say? The Jews. If I asked any Muslim, if Islam is false, who has the truth? Jews. They don't believe in Trinity. Listen carefully. Interesting that Kodesh Baruch Hu, as soon as, remember, one of the things the Mashiach has to do is he's going to rebuild a destroyed temple. Which means the moment the year 70 happens, the moment the Churban Bayis Sheni occurs, in a sense the messianic clock begins to tick. That's why the Medrash says on the day the temple was destroyed, the Mashiach was born. At that moment the messianic age begins to tick away. Any point then the Mashiach can come. The Mashiach can come. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has to fill the world up with two incredible religions that are so perfectly designed that if they are, every one of their followers know that if they're wrong, the Jews are right. And therefore, the moment that the Mashiach comes and they see that it's not Jesus, it's not Moon, it's not any of these people, Muhammad, they instantly will recognize the Jews are right. Now watch this. Although God gives the world, through Christianity and Islam, the basic understanding of one God, the basic concept of a Messiah, the basic understanding of mitzvot and so on, one thing they can't have, and please remember this, Exodus 31, we say it in Kiddush, Shabbos. Oh yeah, you can have the idea of one God, I'll let you have that 7-day week, sure.
mitzvah, you can have that too. Mashiach, you can have some basic ideas about Mashiach. Shabbos, oh, no, no, no. Shabbos is Beni Uvein B'nei Yisrael. Shabbos is only between God and Israel. A goy is chayev misa to keep Shabbos. And therefore, HaKadosh Baruch Hu moves Christianity to Sunday, and he moves Islam to Friday, preserving Shabbos just for the Jewish people. How foolish is the nation that Shabbos has been put aside for you, and we waste it by not keeping it or by not honoring it. Thank you very much.
Very nice. Thank you very much. I want to thank Rabbi Singer. I think one of the important things to note, I know we didn't have enough time, but perhaps, and I'm sure over the course of the next few years before you graduate, Rabbi Singer will come back and really expand on the themes. But one of the things I think you should take note of is specifically a lot of the information you may be getting from Christian missionaries or some of the articles you may read in Newsweek or Time magazine are actually, or some of the arguments you may hear, which sound reasonable. Obviously, not only are there answers for it, but generally the techniques they use follow the same pattern that Rabbi Singer described, which is either taking it out of context or inventing a pasuk that doesn't exist. And the only way to really know what the answers are, as Rabbi Singer was alluding to and will hopefully come back and lecture again on, is basically through knowledge, through the study of Torah. And it's only through the study of Torah, not just Tanakh, but Torah Shebaal Peh, that a person really will have the true answers to questions which are really not solid questions. Okay.